This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Shakespeare has proved to be an endless source of inspiration for creative minds, and such is the case in Gordon Thompson's futuristic interpolation entitled Kill Will. So, Gordon, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
First and foremost, what have you done to my boy Will? And what was the inspiration behind this?
Well, the inspiration is you've got young Will Shakespeare. He's a 15-year-old kid, and for some strange reason, he gets in contact with seven magical druid stones, and as a result, he falls through a portal into present-day England, and all sorts of adventures before, like being picked up by the police, but unbeknownst to him, seven of his female characters have come with him.
Well, here we go. Who are these other women you talk of, I asked. Seven sacred stones have been brought from the divine realm into the world of men, and we seem to be the bearers, or at least that is Ophelia's understanding. Ophelia, it was you heard speaking when I called you before on the shared call. She is elsewhere now, searching for a young woman whose name is Miranda, bearer of a dark green stone. And Ophelia also hopes to find out what happened to a lady named Cordelia, though Cordelia is likely dead. A puff of smoke, dead? I blurted out how. Ophelia may discover it. She has powers of her own. She sees behind the walls of the present world, hears voices of the past, and can detect the whispers of tomorrow. She saw you in your prison. She saw your phone number that I might call you. This is quite a power, said Viola. Has one of the stones given it to her? She has such powers anyway. I think the stone simply gives increase to what is there. As you, my elusive Viola, become more elusive, Cleo finished her pink cigarette and flicked the end out the window. That, by my account, madam, said Viola, is six women that you have named. Is there another? For you said there were seven stones. There is one more of your party, Flora. The Lady Macbeth. Now, you've had to invent a name for Lady M, haven't you?
That's right. I thought Flora was a grand name.
but Flora carries a knife.
She does. She's quite strange.
But which plays have we got here? How many have you called upon, so to speak?
Well, theoretically, seven plays. But because Will Shakespeare is 15, he hasn't written the plays yet. He's got in the back of his mind seven ideas for which these would make great plays one day, and they're stuck in some corner of his consciousness, and they trip him up. They ambush him, in a sense. And
well, didn't he actually steal his plays?
He's a widely read kid. Right?
A widely read kid in his day. The Tempest was one of the original ones that he
that
came
is
up
correct,
with,
yes.
The plot line there. But here we go. We've got another element here, and you're going to have to sort of educate me because my paganism is a little rusty. Seven sacred stones. Now, how close is this to druidic belief?
It's a complete fabulation. I think not a lot is known about the Druids. There's a little bit of architecture and some hints and legends, but on the whole, we think of white robes, oak trees, magic ones, and then people think they maybe levitated the stones for Stonehenge, that sort of thing, but not a lot is known about
They made a potion for Asterix and Obelix.
Oh, there you go, see?
but there was that, well, the druidic belief or the paganism there is in Shakespeare,
yes,
as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, Midsummer Night's Dream and the elements and, well, stones and trees have power, mm-hmm, and significance, as you'll find in a lot of very early cultures and such like.
That's right. And the whole culture itself is teetering on the edge of paganism. It's still very much immersed in that world.
Yeah. But what do your stones do?
Oh, they're simply an invention whereby, look, it's all a grand excuse to have a bit of fun, is really the actual answer to all this. But these stones, they have little qualities like love and death or thievery. You know, there's a magpie stone, and these basically are cosmic stones, and they give life to some of the characters.
Well, also then, you've hinted there that the characters also are imbued with a power unto themselves anyway that is enhanced by the stone, but yes, there to begin with.
Yes.
Is there any one particular character you'd like to bring to the fore? Ophelia has a connection with the other side, could we say?
Or? That's right. Look, in my version, Ophelia is she's a lady of potions and possibly of pagan witchcraft and worships the Norse gods, and coming from Denmark. And so that's her background. And so she has a little bit of insight and second sight, and the magic stone just zhuzhes that up a little
bit.
But
even in her speech in Hamlet, you know, Rosemary, that's for remembrance.
That's right,
and all
yes.
of these sorts of things. So they called upon herbs and potions, which could get you classified as being a witch back then anyway.
Back then, yes.
But now, there's the one narrative going through, and that's with Juliet, and we'll come back to her. But the other narrative then is we have MI3?
MI3, yes. It's a very obscure part of military intelligence. Not many people know about it, but it handles very, very, very cold cases.
And David Cortez is there having to... they've found Will, and two constables come across Will, and there's a recording of the little first interview. Do you want to come and sit on the bench, son? That's right, sit there. So you're from around here then? Do you live on the estate? Estate, my lord? Yes. What's your estate? My estate is low, my lord. Okay, it's okay. Just take a few breaths. I'm PC Arthurs. His accent, remarked Aisha, indicates that he comes from Warwickshire, according to the linguistic analysis we received, noting the rhotic elements. So you've got a very young Will Shakespeare found on a seesaw. He doesn't know what it's for. And the constables find him. But what's he doing in the modern day? And how does David Cortez come into the story here?
Well, young Will, he's just like a lost and lonely kid. He's very confused and he's in a strange world. So it's basically stranger in a strange land. But he happens upon the government agent, or David Cortez seeks him out because of various things. And David's got his own issues because he was attacked by the Sons of Mordred and was nearly burnt alive at the stake. So he's got a bit of a journey of overcoming trauma. And his relationship is bonding with Will, and his action in that helps provide a kind of healing for him, and they develop a really close relationship.
And this provides another narrative through this novel, because you've already alluded to it, the Sons of Mordred, Malcolm Le Fay. So you're actually now sort of utilising Arthurian legend.
That's true, yes.
What is going on? what's going to happen to the state of England?
Well, look, it's Heston's Feast, Heston Blumenthal, the chef, he had this thing where he'd go back into history and invent a feast. And there was a great program on how the Tudors did cuisine. And they do all sorts of things like serve you a pig with duck's wings, you know, and it was kind of fantastical monsters, and the cuisine reflected that. And to a degree, this is a kind of Tudor feast, you know, where, you know, everything is stuck on the wrong way. This novel has wings, but it's a blancmange, a sort of melange of all these different influences.
But it also picks up on this threat then that was extant in, well, Renaissance England anyway, of pretenders to the throne coming to power and usurping control and such like. And you've actually then, contrived or written a bit of correspondence between Reverend John Dee and Sir Francis Walsingham.
Yeah.
Now, I think a lot of people would be familiar with the name Walsingham from the Elizabeth movies and such like. I had to look up John Dee, but a reverend, but also a mathematician and occultist.
Yes. He was interested in the language of angels and looking for seeing stones. So he was keen across all that sort of area. And in fact, the filmmaker Derek Jarman gives him a walk-on part in the movie Jubilee, and it's through his magic that the Queen Elizabeth I character drops into punk England in Jarman's film. So,
But there's this crossover then, because you've got, well, the reverend actually believed in the occult. So, you know, the two are not separate. They are combined. And then you've brought them into the modern age. And here we get this rather interesting crossover that occurs, the Seelies and the drones.
Yes.
So Seelies, what are Seelies?
Well, the unseelie, in a sense, are the spirits and the fairies and the things that you know, sour your milk at night and the things that kind of crack the window and make you slip on the cobblestones. They are doing that sort of stuff. And you want to keep away from them. They are kind of dark forces, witchy forces associated with Morgana Le Fay, that kind of
thing. But it's not so hard to then think of drones whizzing by and you think, well, what was that? Where does that come from? Like a
spirit?
Well, that's
right, yes. I mean, there's the impact of modern technology comes into the story as well, and there are drone attacks, you know, sort of cars get blown up. There are all sorts of adventurous things happening. But certainly, I think you might recall that Arthur C. Clarke thing that any advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So these things are so developed, like AI, yeah, it seems like a kind of magic.
Well, mobile, you know, phones, so who would have thought?
It's pixie dust. You
yeah,
know,
and how mobile phones work without any sort of connection,
yes,
concrete connection.
Correct.
We have illegal immigrants. He's a time traveller, actually, an illegal immigrant.
Well, one of the things I do like is that Juliet, you know, she's wandering London looking for Romeo, so she thinks, and then she gets picked up by UK Border Force and put in immigration detention.
The English have no respect for their cultural heroes, do they? But here we go. You've got Juliet, who actually manages to return, and you've to her own time, but we can't give away what actually happens. But what is the, well, how to frame this question then in terms of bringing a modern perspective to the relationship she thought she had? I mean, initially you've got her being abused. Well, better be careful how I use that word, basically kidnapped by her own father and sent away, which is very close, in fact, to
the original.
The original, because Daddy was going to banish her, so she ends up banished. But she goes back and she actually finds Romeo at a challenge. We've got to be careful how we talk about this.
Yes, there's the challenge to either accept him or reject him. But certainly with in my telling of it, she's dominated by the father. There's a very strong father figure, an abusive father figure. And then she escapes from that when she comes to our world. But then she falls in with a very strong mother figure in the form of Cleopatra. So in a sense, you got this. You could read it in a Jungian way, that she's being dominated by archetypes and she needs to kind of somehow devour those and develop her own understanding.
Then take this back. Mm-hmm. And so how would that then, and you're not going to answer this question because people have to read the book for themselves,
yes,
how does this then play out when she meets Romeo again and what has happened there? That image of that romantic image, which people still fall in love with, young love, etc., and it being reevaluated, reassessed in some ways.
Well, it gives her the strength. I mean, this processing of, you know, the on one side the antagonistic father or the antagonistic mother, she gets through that and she's developing her own strength in order to have that confrontation. But she also does find love in an unexpected place with
Well, there are interesting characters she encounters which aren't necessarily they're the other side of the law. You've got Angus, who actually has given her a mobile phone.
That's right. Angus, he sells stolen mobile phones and they meet and kind of fall in love.
So, you know, a contemporary version of Romeo, perhaps, on the wrong side of the law.
Yes.
Misbehaving. So we've got all of this occurring and happening in the novel Kill Will by Gordon Thompson, and it is a Clandestine Press release. So, Gordon, thank you very much for coming in and talking with me today.
Oh, look, thanks so much for taking the time, David. That's great. Thanks for your interest.
Worry. Now I've got a pre-record to play Jan's interview with Ian Kemish.
Ian Kemish has a big CV of international diplomatic work, and now he can add riveting fictional author to that. Welcome, Ian.
Thank you so much, Jan. Great to be with you.
Your book's title is Two Islands. Where are they, and when have you set this story?
The two islands, one larger, one much smaller, are situated somewhere in the Hebridean Sea off the west coast of Scotland, my mother's country, where my family originate. The islands don't actually exist, but they're based on islands I have known and places I've spent a lot of time in my life.
You give us a map of Skarsny and Thorkell Isle. How do you get from one island to the other?
At low tide, you can walk between the two. And the passage between the two islands actually plays an important role in the story. I won't give away how.
But
the passage is important. At high tide, it's a dangerous current.
You also give us a map of Lamhraeg village. How did I go with the pronunciation?
I'd say Lamhraeg. Any pronunciation's right because it doesn't exist. The proximity of these two islands and the ability to walk between one another, there are such places. There are, for example, the islands of Colonsay and Oronsay in the Hebridean Sea.
Also have a little mud map of some of the houses there. And there's Mrs. Hendy's house. How would you describe her?
Well, Mrs. Henty is actually very firmly based on a lady who lived on another island who was my granny's landlady. And my granny lived in a small lean-to alongside her house. As a young man, I used to have to stoop down to enter into the house. The real lady, upon whom Mrs. Henty is partly based, was a forceful character. She had Gaelic as her native language. She was a real character.
She hasn't left the island in years, but still constantly complains about the ferry service that doesn't operate in times of bad weather.
That's true, and this is a real feature of island life, and of course stormy weather sometimes puts it out. These are places which are lovely to visit, but to live year round, including through the winter, can be a challenge, and people are very supportive of each other. They're really good people out there.
Next to her house is the shop owned by Donald, and his daughter Lois has moved away but just come back.
Yeah, she's had a very difficult time of it in Glasgow, and she's got a bit of a love-hate relationship with the islands, but she's back and she's taking refuge, if you like, in family and in community.
Ronnie lives in the rundown hotel on the other side of Mrs. Henty. What does Ronnie do all day?
Ronnie finds his purpose in life by being helpful to the old folk around the island. He is somebody who has his own challenges. He lives in a run-down house which used to be the village's only real guest house. And he just tries to be helpful.
The biggest area of land is the farm owned by McCaffrey. How's his popularity in town?
Pretty low. He's somebody who, as my granny would have said, thinks himself and very much sees himself as a cut above the rest. He's a bit self-centred and cutthroat, and he doesn't like outsiders. He doesn't like outsiders at all.
And he knows that there's somebody living in a ruined cottage on Thirkell's Island, and he doesn't approve of it. So this is Fergus.
Yeah, Fergus is a central character. There are four really in this book. Fergus is somebody who we discover slowly during the course of the book.
A quote, a grim, silent man with a shock of red hair could occasionally be seen staring vacantly out to the sea from the higher slopes. So how's Fergus accepted by the village people?
With people like the farmer, he's very much rejected, and he'd like to see him off the island quick smart. The others, it's a mix. Mrs. Henty calls him Slow Fergus, and she'll say a little bit too loudly that he's touched in the head to the others. But there is a willingness to look out for him among several of the islanders, and each of them progressively show their generosity and their kindness. And in the end, this is a book about goodness.
Nico, 22-year-old, comes to the island with a tent and seems to be hiding. It has something to do with what he witnessed 6 years ago. Where?
So Nico is from what we called then former Yugoslavia, even then former Yugoslavia. He's, to be precise, he's a young Croatian. He has survived something unspeakable, an atrocity that was committed in his hometown in the early 90s. It's firmly based on a real event, and he is willing to tell the world about it, but he is frightened. And it is fear that has driven him to the edge of Europe, to the edge of the Atlantic.
This was the most complicated war. You were able to use your characters, an Australian embassy official, so that we got a sense of it. So this is Ian Kemmich reading from his book, Two Islands.
Yeah, so this is an Australian official who happens to have the job that I once had. And he's talking about how and why this war started. He'd taken her back to the outbreak of the conflict in 1991, when the Serbian president in Belgrade, Slobodan Milosevic, launched military attacks against Slovenia and Croatia after they announced their independence from Yugoslavia. He explained that when it became obvious that preserving Yugoslavia was a lost cause, Belgrade's military forces had refocused on defending and extending pockets of Serb-occupied land in Croatia, fighting alongside local Serbs who said they'd rather die than be incorporated into a country run by Croats. Together, they'd pored over a detailed map which showed the current ethnic and military dispositions across Croatia, and then Julian pointed to the near-landlocked republic that adjoined it. The only part of Yugoslavia where the ethnic picture was even more complicated was here, he told her, laying his finger on neighbouring Bosnia. When Bosnia declared its independence a year after the others, the whole thing exploded into a violent triangular war between Muslims, Serbs and Croats.
He was explaining that to Anita Costello. So what's her job?
Anita is an AFP officer who is seconded to what was called the International Criminal Tribunal for Former Yugoslavia. We often refer to it by its location, the Hague Tribunal. It was the first time the international community had established a force, a jurisdiction, to go after people who had committed war crimes. Yes, we'd had the Nuremberg trials after World War II, but this was a collective international action sanctioned by the UN Security Council. It was highly successful, actually, in bringing down and bringing to justice several war criminals, and several of them remain in custody today. Anita works for that outfit, as many Australians did. Mm-hmm. The deputy prosecutor of the tribunal was an Australian at the time. They worked as forensic investigators, enforcers. And Anita is a very tough woman.
She was advised, quote, get their confidence, take their statement and move on. But she couldn't with Nico. She could not keep an emotional distance.
That's right. And I've talked to people who have done this work. They've reflected to me about how difficult it is to keep that distance. I've spoken to a guy called Brendan Rook, who worked for the International Criminal Court, who said that, you know, you try very hard to keep that distance, be focused on the job, but ultimately it is difficult because the human suffering that's playing out in front of you is so real and people are so brave. Anita, there's something special about Nico for Anita, but she's doing her job well.
Nico reminded her so much of her younger brother back in Australia. Anita organised Nico to move to London for safety, but she's back in Australia when he needs help. So who else can Nico call on?
Yeah, exactly. And she feels that she has let Nico down. She's torn a bit, as many Australian expatriates working out there in the world are, between the job at hand and her family at home, where she has, you know, some real challenges to deal with. She's just doing her best. And Nico ultimately feels he can only look to himself for help. And he runs.
So he's running. And this is where he ends up, in this little village. And when he comes to Donald's shop and doesn't have enough money for biscuits, Donald lets him take these and also puts in a chocolate bar. And you can tell Nico is a good boy, a 22-year-old, by what he does. He just goes out the back and chops wood.
Exactly.
Yeah. McCaffrey, however, threatens Nico as he camps near his farm. So Nico attempts to cross over to Torkel's Isle, and this is where he meets Fergus.
Yeah, he does. And there's a bit of hostility between these guys. I won't sort of talk about too much about what happens here, but there is some real hostility. And this is something you learn fairly early in the book. for some reason, Fergus identifies Nico in terms of, you know, where he's from. He knows where he's from, and this is a mystery to Nico. And this is part of the slow reveal. And the relationship evolves and changes over time.
The villagers organise work and housing for Nico and feel they should do something for Fergus as well. As readers, we learn a little about the complications of witnessing war atrocities, whether it's Second World War, Northern Ireland, well, it's now called PTSD, but on the island of Skarsny, there is a physical threat from two, quote, two silent, dangerous-looking men following him, watching him, the men Nico was running from. So how can old folk and a hermit possibly protect him? And we're not going to tell Ian Gamish because that's what makes this a very, very good book. You do use some real names in this, and you mention criminals hiding in plain sight. Arkin.
Yeah, Arkin, it was the name by which he was most commonly known. He was the most famous Serbian war criminal in the early 1990s. So his forces were present at the city of Vukovar, which was decimated by Serb forces, both military and these gangs, of which Arkin was, you know, the leader of the largest of them. He was also directly responsible, he and his people, for some terrible things that happened in northern Bosnia over subsequent years. He flaunted it. This guy was a petty criminal who had managed to escape justice in Western Europe over the years. He flaunted it. He was protected in Belgrade by the government. And ultimately, he was gunned down. He's a real person, and he's dealt very deliberately into the story.
On a lighter side, there is the Beltane Festival and a touch of romance with Lois. Is it Fergus, Nico, or her old boyfriend Peter? Another bit we're not going to disclose.
Certainly not going to disclose that, are we?
The trauma of war links a small community on an island off Scotland, massacres in Bosnia, and an Australian war crimes investigator in Ian Kemish's thriller, Two Islands. Thank you so much for such a good read.
Thanks so much, Jan. Great to be with you.